to order. We are still looking for other members. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2938. I will call Mr. Steve Anderson.
Good to see you, Steve.
Thank you, Mark. I'm Steve Anderson. I'm a consulting engineer from LeGrand, Oregon. I'm here on behalf of my firm of Anderson Perry. We're a 70-person consulting civil engineering surveying firm with offices in Baker City and LeGrand and Hermiston, as well as Walla Walla. And I'm here to talk about the proposed amendments to House Bill 2938. In a letter of November 4, 1996, to Senator David Nelson, I said that in 1939, the Oregon State Legislature passed a statute, ORS 366.155H, that allowed the Oregon State Department of Transportation to provide free bridge design engineering to counties throughout Oregon. That 60-year-old statute is still on the books today, and as a result of it, many counties, particularly in central and eastern Oregon, continue to use ODOT exclusively for this work. I'm a strong defender of the private sector, and I believe that government should only provide services where these services cannot be obtained at a reasonable cost through the private sector. In 1939, there may not have been firms like our own in the region, and that was the reason for this legislation at that time. That is not the case anymore. In a letter that Terry Scheich, then the state bridge engineer, wrote to Representative Ray Baum in September of 1996, the state bridge engineer himself said, quote, "The free county bridge design services, ORS 366.155H, was established in Oregon as law in 1939. The real purpose of this law has been lost to time, but one can surmise that the counties were very young in their roadway engineering ability and may not have had the expertise to perform bridge engineering. They likely needed outside help. It is possible that the only source was the state. Today's climate is very different. Most local agencies are very capable of finding help through the consultant industry. The ODOT bridge section provides services to the local agencies not in competition with the consultant industry, but at the request of the local agencies in accordance with the statutes." I guess what I'm here today to talk to you about is the fact that this is an obsolete law. I think it's a law that should have been sunsetted some 20 or 30 years ago. I've been in business in the area for some 25 years, starting in 1973. I think it's a discriminatory law. First of all, I think it discriminates against the cities because it doesn't include cities. It just includes counties. And about half of the bridges in Oregon that are owned by local agencies are owned by cities rather than by counties, or some amount anyway. Also, it favors counties and road districts and somewhat discriminates against counties that don't specifically request such assistance when they make application to ODOT. There's no such thing as free. This is a cost to the taxpayers in the state of Oregon. It opens up the door for ODOT to offer services to counties that are available from the private sector, firms such as my own. And the thing that I think is most bothersome to me, it is a carrot that attracts counties to use the bridge design services of ODOT when these services are available from a firm like my own. And if you look at the information that I've provided to you, you see that it's a very small carrot, because the portion that's free is only a small portion of the total cost of engineering on a project. Yet many times it's what's necessary to draw the local agency to use the services of the state rather than to come to a private sector. And I think last but not least, I'd like to say that I think it pulls jobs away from the rural And in my case, when this work is done by ODOT staff, it's done by ODOT staff in Salem, by design engineers that live in Salem, while design engineers that are sitting in my office are without the benefit of this work. And I think that by repealing this law, I think we'll open the door up to organizations like my own and others to be able to do this work effectively for the cities and counties throughout the state, and I think that's where it should be done.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. You said your firm employs 70 individuals currently.
Yeah.
That's with among the several locations.
Right, in the four offices that we have. We have about 40 of those people in Oregon and 30 of them in Washington.
Can you tell me about the funding process for funding bridges, county bridges? Didn't a certain segment of that funding come from ODOT? A certain amount of that funding?
The funding varies, but in most cases the funding is about 80% federal, 10% state, and 10% local. And the free part of it that the counties are really getting is they're getting, they're not having to pay the 10% local share of that portion of the design work that is done by ODOT. So it's a very small part. It's almost free.
How much of ODOT design and engineering and design workloads do they handle in-house, and how much do they contract out?
ODOT is very good about contracting out their work, and I'm not here to complain about ODOT. I think ODOT is a fine agency, and I think ODOT does a good job of contracting out. My concern here is that the statute, I think, encourages a liaison between ODOT and between the counties for this bridge work that could otherwise be done by the private sector and could be done just as efficiently by the private sector. I guess in direct answer to your question, I think ODOT probably does about 60 to 70% of their work in-house, and about 30 to 40% of the work is contracted out, which is typical of transportation agencies across the nation. They let the consultants take the peaks and valleys off the workload.
How many engineering firms were in place in rural Oregon when this statute went on the books? Do you have any idea?
I think most of the firms in our area were basically survey firms. And I think now you'll find it in Bend and Lakeview and Mount Vernon and LeGrand, and they're all over the place now.
So the need has changed over time.
I think there's a good representation of qualified firms in our area to provide this service now, in both, particularly in Region 4 and Region 5.
Okay. Mr. Starr, you have a question?
No, I'm just too careful. It's good.
Okay, if you'd be willing to stand by, I'm going to call up Bill Finhollow and Laura Pryor.
Sure.
Just step down and be available for more questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Laura Pryor, and I'm the county judge from Dillon County, Oregon. I'm here today to represent the Association of Oregon Counties, but more importantly, specifically the eight smallest counties in the state that are under 9,000 population. I would like to also say that I wish I was representing the 60% of Oregon cities that are 1,000 people or less. There are a lot of small cities in Oregon and in eastern Oregon.
So 60% that are 1,000?
1,000 or less, yes, of the city. Actually, I think it's a little bit more than 60%. But my concern is with those real small jurisdictions. My concern also is that, at least in east of the mountain for all of these counties, are the revenues available to those counties to be able to apply to the roads and the bridge needs has changed dramatically in the last 5 or 6 years. A lot of those counties out there have lost between 62% and 80-some% of their timber revenues, which were used for roads. that's occurred at the same time that you've had Measure 5 and 47 and 50, which hit the small cities and the small counties the hardest on their general funds. The valuation in those counties are not growing. Probably the valuation in at least five of those eight counties is below now what it was in 1939. It's less. So the concern that we have here is, although the amount of money that ODOT furnishes may be a small percentage of the total cost of engineering, it does sometimes make the difference for those real small jurisdictions on whether they can get a project done or not. Frankly, the likelihood of that is waning as those revenues decline. But this is a piece of legislation that does offer some assistance to those little projects. And that's why I'm going to ask you that you consider not removing this from the statute.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. I think all of you have heard the debate that we've been involved in recently about the need for highway funds, additional highway funds for counties, the cities, and ODOT. Your own legislative fiscal office did an analysis earlier this year and indicates that counties have a biennial shortfall projected for this next biennium in excess of $500 million. The counties that we're focusing on here, the Eastern Oregon counties, the 12 Eastern Oregon counties, you'll recall, have lost $25 million in federal forest revenues since 1990. Those same counties we've been trying to get passed in the transportation package, a very meager $3 million replacement for that $25 million loss. Those counties are further impacted by having to deal with many, many miles of roads. There's, you know, Mr. Chair, in Eastern Oregon, there's large spanses of area, and the county is basically responsible for providing access to those land masses. Counties are responsible for 27,000 miles of the 40,000 miles of state roads, county roads, and city streets. And 3,400, over half of the bridges, fall under the responsibility of the county. With about $1 in resources for every $3 in need. So we feel that this is a very important program for the small counties. We would oppose removing this special provision from the statute. It continues to be used in counties like Morrow and Wheeler and Wallowa and Sherman and Gillum, a number of the small counties. And I have a letter here, too, Mr. Chair, from Commissioner Mike Hayward from Wallowa County. And this was what Commissioner Hayward submitted to Representative Bob Montgomery's House Transportation Committee earlier this year. But I think this kind of summarizes the problem that those counties in Far Eastern Oregon have. They indicate that in 1993-94, Wallowa County received about $1.1 million in timber receipts. In 1994, that dropped to $262,000. And more recently, 1 year later, it dropped to $122,000. The Commissioner Hayward said that Wallowa County doesn't have the local resources to offset those financial losses. Our road department has gone from 22 staff to 9, and they have reduced our purchasing to the bare minimum and are operating on bare minimum budget. That's Wallowa County. That's typical of many of those counties in the eastern part of the state. And, Mr. Chair, we feel that this would create an additional hardship on those counties.
Thank you, Mr. Penhall. I appreciate you coming today. How do we, and I'm very intimately aware of the problems with small counties, and particularly eastern counties, and the shortfalls in timber revenues and such. But, how do we at the same time justify using taxpayer dollars to compete with the private sector and, in effect, undermine efforts at local economic development and export high-paying jobs that could be out in the rural parts of the state to save them?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I might. Mr. Chairman, I'm also going to ask the committee to remember that the roads that we're talking about are gravel. So we're not even talking about asphalt roads here. So when you get to designing a bridge, that's going to be a very expensive thing for counties whose road systems primarily dirt and rock. So the engineering that has to go into that, that project probably going to be one of the most expensive projects that the county will do. And when we're talking about these small counties. So by and large, the county's not going to have the leisure to say, should we keep this project in the private sector, or should we ask ODOT to help us with this? They're going to have a finite amount of money, which is going to dictate they either do the job or they don't do the job. So they don't really have that as an issue or a decision point for them. If they can get the job done with the private sector, I'm sure they'll do it, because they're cognizant of that as well. But if they can't, it will force them to try to get the job done through ODOT.
Commissioner Pryor, I appreciate the difficulty in funding these projects. I live on a gravel road about 3 miles out of Elgin, and there is a new bridge that I cross on Reinhardt Road every time I head this direction before I get to the pavement. And I fully appreciate the cost involved, but still the glaring question remains is why are we encouraging the exporting of good-paying jobs from areas of the state that are admittedly suffering economically? And some of the firms who do have staff available could be providing the service that the state is providing in Salem, and they could be providing that service to private means in the communities all around the rural parts of the state.
Commissioner, Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to debate that with you, because I think there's some justification in that Sherman Wheeler and Gillum do not have an engineer within 100 miles of them.
Mr. Chair, I might add, too, that I think in your county they have chosen to use consulting engineers, and I think the bridge that you travel over probably was designed by a consulting engineer. However, I would add to what Judge Pryor has said that I don't think it's a matter of having necessarily a choice, considering the loss of revenues and the fact that they're trying now to manage their road facilities and their bridges with fewer dollars today than they had in 1990. I think it's a matter of not doing the project, delaying the project for an indefinite amount of time if they don't have this option available to them.
Thank you. I'm sure seeing these amendments that we're talking about, it seems to me that they go far beyond bridges and culverts. If I read what they do, it eliminates the county governing body from asking the ODOT to help on a variety of other things as well. Mm-hmm. Isn't that correct?
That is Representative Chairman.
How much of the other services used relating to road location, construction, and maintenance? It is significantly broader than just bridges.
It is, and I'm sure that on occasion there are assistance provided by ODOT in these various areas. But as the subsection reads, there is the ability for ODOT to charge for that additional assistance if the county requests it. It's just in the bridge design area where it is free of charge to the local jurisdiction, to the county.
Okay. Could I follow up, Mr. Chairman? Probably some of you know that our county is host to the regional landfill that takes the solid waste from Seattle and Portland. Our county road was impacted badly when that occurred, and we didn't have a lot of revenue to deal with it. We did ask ODOT to act as project manager on that project for us because we couldn't afford to hire a project manager out of the private sector. We tried, and it was just cost prohibitive. The engineering and everything was done in the private sector, but the piece we couldn't get done was we couldn't hire someone that was skilled enough to be able to help us protect that road, and they did that for us. They were paid for it, but they were the only ones that were willing to do it.
What if we amended this to provide that under the county's under 9,000 population, we left this in force that further required that ODOT provide that service through local consultants to the greatest degree possible? How would you?
I think that's fine.
You would then your opposition to the bill would go away.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm looking to see the population factor in which the Eastern Oregon counties are in that group of 12, and Baker County is at 16,500. Wasco County is at 22,500. I think it may cause somewhat of a hardship for those counties. I think it does take care of the bulk of the counties. I don't think we would have objection to amendments that would say that in applying this particular statute to all the counties that ODOT give consideration to using the private sector. I think that's certainly
located nearby.
Pardon me?
Geographically located in the region.
Well, if that, Mr. Chair, if that does not create a conflict with the public contracting statute, so I think that would be okay.
That may create a conflict. Okay, further questions? Mr. Kimball, could you come up?
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're talking about bridges and culverts, but this statute, this paragraph in the statute, deals on a broader issue. It says that the counties can basically negotiate with ODOT on a price on other activities. Can you tell me how what kind of agreements have been reached on some of those, and how much money, and is there a percentage that is charged, or how that works in some of these other things outside from bridges and culverts?
Chair Simmons, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, maintenance engineer with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Chair Simmons, Representative Starr, it's straight. We bill our costs is what we bill out to the counties for those things for which we charge them for. I checked with legislative council when I saw this bill. Your concern about stopping counties from working with ODOT, and they said that it simply takes us out of the statute. There's nothing that limits our ability to do intergovernmental agreements and continue to work with counties like we have been doing in the past. It just takes away the free part. I think what the statute was developed, it says it tells ODOT to that they're there for the counties if the counties ask. I don't know what the situation was at the time. Now, if a county asks us for help, it's not. I mean, we're working with the counties, actively working with the counties.
Just a follow up. If you, how much of this work do you use private companies for, and do you use them in a region located near the county that the work gets done?
Chair Simmons, Representative Starr, I can't. I think Mr. Anderson's characterization of our use of consultants is about right. How many of these specific jobs that enters into, I don't know. But we have no way within public contracting laws to say we want a firm in this area. When we bid the job goes out to whoever's on the list.
It's in Devlin.
Prior times when I've looked at ODOT budgets, this could count for many different things, but sometimes I've seen, you know, line items relating to assistance to local governments, and I assume that there's probably revenue items in other areas showing revenue coming in from local governments. Would that be where these transactions would be accounted for? Are they accounted for in the budgeting process?
Chair Simmons, Representative Devlin, I believe this design has shown up in the past as an indirect charge in the bridge program, what formerly the construction limitation, now with the new budget structure, it will be the bridge limitation. I think the charges will switch from indirect to direct, so it will be a specific. It already is specific. We had a specific accounting code type of work, but it's, I believe, all been covered in the bridge program. I think the local transfers that you're referring to are actually money that we is in our budget identified for us to transfer out to the local agencies.
Let's turn it all up.
It's in Devlin.
In a broad sense, in broad dollar figures, what might be the value of this assessment?
Chair Simmons, Representative Devlin, our estimate was that the fiscal impact to ODOT was $200,000 of benefit, $200,000 of biennium to ODOT, consequent impact to the county.
Commissioner Breyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If this bill is the path as is, would you anticipate that the engineering design staff at ODOT would need to be reduced?
Representative Simmons, Representative Breyer, I don't know. That would not be. This is amount to 10, 12 bridges of biennium. Somewhere between 8 and 12 bridges of biennium. It's not a significant impact to our workload.
Okay.
If this were to pass and the county would have to go to private, they'd have to go through the same public contracting process that ODOT has to, which means that they wouldn't necessarily have jobs for their folks that were bid locally. Or near. Aren't some people bid pretty much region-wide?
Chair Simmons, Representative Starr, I'm not positive of how county contracting works. I don't know what their specific requirements are. Mr. Penhall may be able to answer that question better than me.
Mr. Penhall.
And for the record, Bill Penhall, representing the Association of Morgan Counties, Chair Representative Starr. Counties would use what is called a qualification-based selection process for selecting an engineer or an architect or a surveyor to do this kind of work. In that process, qualifications are the primary consideration, so a location would have some implication, but would not be a primary consideration.
So it's not a competitive bid type of a situation.
No.
Where it's just, you know, we need to spend an engineer.
They get the submissions from qualified engineering firms. That is a prerequisite.
They have to advertise it somehow.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, you would go through a advertising process. You would receive the qualifications from the interested engineering firms. The selection committee would go through and rank the submittals based upon qualifications, and then would generally look at price and other considerations in arriving at a choice. But predominantly, it deals with the individual's qualifications and the ability to perform the kind of work that should be done.
Thank you, Chairman.
Okay. We will close the public hearing on HB 2938 and open the work session on HB 2938. And if we were to limit this colleague to have a keep the service available for counties with a population of 9,000 or less, that may be appropriate for some of the real small counties throughout the central part of the state. And we can have, kind of settle down the road of a conceptual amendment today, or have an amendment brought back for our consideration tomorrow morning, if we can get it drafted in time.
Mr. Chairman, it might be better to get us to bring it back tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, number might be better also, like 10,000.
Pardon me.
9,000. Any number is pretty arbitrary, but 9,000.
There are some definite breaking points in the population of the United States. The information provided to me from OEDD demonstrated earlier this session some things to work on for tax, long-term taxpayers for rural counties. I'll go back to consult that and see what we can add to that. Is that a question for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair, under the 9,000, how many counties would that affect?
Mr. Pryor? Under 9,000, how many counties would that affect? Under 9,000 population? You need to talk to the microphone.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, there are 8, Morrow, Grant, Lake, Harney, Wallala, Sherman, Gillum, and Wheeler. They go from 1,600 a county to 9,000.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Marty, we will close the work session on 2938 then, and come back to it in the morning. We do have a meeting from 9 to 10 tomorrow morning. We will go now to a public hearing on HCR 86. Open that public hearing.
Okay, we've got a public hearing. Judith, for you, talking about
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You have at your seats the Dash 1 amendment to HJR 86. If you will look at those amendments, it does replace the entire first paragraph of the resolution, basically everything in the resolution except for the actual referral to the people. In the Dash 1 amendments, the measure does a few things. First of all, it does state that any state statute authorizing or requiring the award of attorney's fees to a public body in a civil action shall also authorize an award of attorney's fees to other prevailing parties who are adverse to the public body. You'll see two sections here, sub 1 and sub 2, not to be confusing. They are not the exact same wording. You'll see on line 6 it refers to statutes authorizing an award, and on line 12 we need the exact same language but statutes that require an award. Subsection 3 is there stating that it'll be a fair, the award would be on the same basis to the other prevailing parties as they would to the public body. Subsection 4 I wanted to point out to you because it seems to be saying that it's not, will not authorize or require an award of attorney fees to a public body, but the reason that language is in there is to not have to require the courts to award attorney fees, pardon me, award attorney fees to a public body when they are suing each other. So that would be so that one public body doesn't have to pay attorney's fees for another public body that prevails in a suit. You'll see that in Subsection 5, definitions of public bodies. And then finally, Section 10A of the resolution shows an effective date of 2002. The reason that's in there, the delay is in there till 2002, is so that the 2001 Legislative Assembly could make the appropriate revisions to state law based on the provisions should the constitutional amendment pass. And then, that particular 10A section is repealed, just again repealing the effective date when it's going into effect. You'll find also a fiscal estimate at your spot showing just the cost of adding this resolution to the ballot, $44,500 approximately for the actual voter's pamphlet incremental cost, as well as $2,100 for the elections division.
Thank you, Representative Devlin.
Just a clarification from committee staff. It says this is an HJR with a constitutional amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any necessity that the substance of HJR is a gap on amendments that have to be constitutional rather than statutory?
I would refer to Legislative Council for this year, Dave Hendricks.
Mr. Hendricks, if I understand it, this is a referral of a constitutional amendment to dash one that states the replacement of the original bill. But is there any reason why what's in dash one, other than the vehicle that we're using, would have to be a constitutional amendment versus a statute?
Chair Starr, Vice Chair Representative Devlin, Dave Hendricks, Deputy Legislative Counsel. What is in paragraph 1 is reflected in the dash 1 amendment. In essence, was originally considered as an amendment in a bill. It certainly can be done as a statutory provision, since basically it's saying what the legislature can do in the way of a statute in this type of situation, basically requiring reciprocity in awards of attorney's fees between a public body and an individual. So we could go through and amend all the statutes to do this. Of course, by putting it in the Constitution, it will be a requirement that the legislature do that, and that's the essential difference.
Is there any other questions? Thank you very much. We'll call John DiLorenzo. Mr. Gillian, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney in Portland. I've also asked Mr. Joe Gilliam of NFIB to come up with me so we could appear more as a panel to expedite your hearing somewhat. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Litigation Reform Coalition to propose the amendment you have just heard described to HGR 86. By way of background, the Oregon Litigation Reform Coalition was extremely active during the 1995 and 1997 legislative sessions and advanced proposals for witness tort reform, six of which were adopted by the Legislative Assembly and signed by the governor. Those proposals related to reform of the law of punitive damages, limitations on the use of racketeering laws in general commercial litigation, revisions to the law of joint several liability, and in some cases, laws which permitted defendants to petition courts for award of attorney's fees in civil litigation when they prevailed. The Litigation Reform Coalition changed its emphasis somewhat during the 1997 session of the legislature and began to address inequities which the regulated community perceived to exist in litigation involving private parties and the state. This session, the Litigation Reform Coalition has helped to actively urge and develop House Bill 2525, a compromise bill which provides independent hearings officers in contested cases for administrative agencies. That bill was just passed by the full House on June 24th and was unanimously adopted by the Senate on the 29th of this month. The amendments we propose today address other relationships between private parties and the state. This amendment requires the government to pay the reasonable attorney's fees of any person who is not a public body who prevails in any civil judicial proceeding to which the government is a party whenever the government has a statutory entitlement to attorney's fees. Specifically, at line 5 of the proposed amendment, the Constitution would be amended to provide that when any statute authorizes an award of attorney's fees to a prevailing public body, that the statute must also authorize an award of attorney's fees to any private party who prevails. At line 11, the proposed constitutional amendment provides that when a statute requires the award of attorney's fees to a public body which prevails, then the statute must also require an award of attorney's fees to the private party who prevails. At line 16, the proposed constitutional amendment requires that any award of attorney's fees to a private party must be on the same basis as that provided by a statute for an award of attorney's fees to the public body. At line 19, the proposed constitutional amendment clarifies that the amendment does not authorize or require any award of attorney's fees in a situation where there are dueling public bodies involved in litigation. At line 22, the proposed constitutional amendment defines public body. And finally, on page 2, at line 9, as your committee administrator has stated, the proposed constitutional amendment, if adopted by the voters, would become effective January 1, 2002. This is because there are in excess of 125 statutes which currently provide for one-way fees in favor of the government. In other words, many statutes currently provide that where the state or a public body prevails in litigation, they are entitled to attorney's fees. But if a private party prevails in the same action, the private party has either no such entitlement to attorney's fees or in some cases an entitlement only if the action brought by the government had no reasonably objective basis in law or fact. The delay of the effective date would allow the next session of the Oregon Legislature to make policy choices as it reviews each of these effective statutes. For instance, to comply with the constitutional amendment, you may wish to provide for an award of attorney's fees in certain cases to private parties on an equal basis, as provided to the public body. On the other hand, you may deem it better policy to just delete the public body's entitlement to an award of attorney's fees in certain cases altogether, in which case there would then be no entitlement for attorney's fees to the private body. Now, the following are, from my vantage point, the philosophic underpinnings associated with this amendment. First, I truly believe that a free society should maintain a healthy distrust of government. The government, as we know, if allowed to operate without strict controls, can, under some circumstances, trample upon individual rights. We rely upon our judicial branch, in large part, to curb governmental excesses. Although we believe that our agencies and our local governments are directed by persons of high caliber, we should not have to depend upon the good graces of those who occupy administrative offices to be assured that the government will never abuse its authority. Rather, the law should provide for built-in safeguards, assuring that those abuses will not occur. Secondly, whenever the government litigates against a private party, it devotes significant resources towards prosecution of its claim. I have witnessed many occasions in which private parties have been unable to wage principled defenses because of the cost of the litigation. Without an opportunity to recover attorney's fees, most private parties who are sued by the government acquiesce rather than face bankruptcy over the high cost of waging a principled defense. This situation is more pronounced when the government can recover attorney's fees in addition to the other remedies to which it's entitled when it wins, but the private party cannot. And third, absent the risk of exposure for attorney's fees, the government does not always wisely select the cases it chooses to pursue. There are occasions in which private parties will go the distance in litigation against the state when principle is involved. But expending the time and effort to wage a principled defense is not always an economically wise decision. Of course, government litigators know this, and often, in my opinion, count on a private party acquiescing when he considers how expensive it is to fight City Hall. Now, there has been some related legislation that has touched upon this area, especially in the Senate. Senator Bryant and Representative Williams have on several occasions attempted to engage the Attorney General's office in discussions concerning another bill, Senate Bill 961. Senate Bill 961, in its original form, provided for an automatic award of attorney's fees whenever a private party prevailed against the state or a local government. It was amended in the Senate Judiciary Committee in an effort to address objections that were made by the Attorney General's office that the bill's provisions, were not reciprocal. In the form in which it passed the Senate, the bill provided only that when the government lost twice, at trial and then upon appeal, only then would a private party be entitled to attorney's fees. Even with those changes, the bill has still been opposed by the Attorney General's office. Any discussions I have had to date with the Attorney General's office concerning any compromised version of Senate Bill 961 have been completely unavailing. In fact, I believe I can fairly say that the Attorney General's office has been opposed to every version of Senate Bill 961 which has been suggested, and is likely going to be opposed to the amendments which we are proposing today. Because the Attorney General's office will likely request the governor to veto any version of Senate Bill 961 which the legislature may enact, the Oregon Litigation Reform Coalition felt it might be more appropriate to propose this constitutional amendment. I can personally think of nothing fairer than to allow private parties an entitlement to attorney's fees on the same basis as is afforded to the government. There are in excess, as I mentioned before, of 125 statutes currently in the books which contain the disparity which we have noted here today. The constitutional amendment, if enacted by the voters, will allow the legislature the entire 2001 session to analyze these statutes and to make policy choices. There is no more equitable way to provide for fee shifting with respect to the government than by having a reciprocity provision in the Constitution. Should a statute allow the government attorney's fees upon prevailing, a private party would also be entitled to attorney's fees upon prevailing. Should the government not be entitled to an award of attorney's fees upon prevailing, then neither would the private party. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, in conclusion, one real way to rein in the overwhelming power of the government when it litigates is to create some exposure for attorney's fees when it loses. This exposure can be created either by requiring the government to pay when it loses or by requiring the government to absorb the cost of litigation. In other words, not provide it any award of attorney's fees. Private parties, conversely, should be provided the same opportunity to either recover their cost of defense or to have no exposure for the government's attorney's fees because, members of the committee, private parties should be encouraged to wage principled defenses. Senate Bill 961 originally required the government to pay attorney's fees whenever it lost. Frankly, the Oregon Litigation Reform Coalition believes that that should be the rule. Now we propose yet another modification in the hope that the bill's opponents will appreciate the efforts which we have made to search for some common ground. Although we would have wished for more, the proposed amendment is still excellent policy in our view. The best watchdog against government abuse is its citizenry. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I ask you to give the citizenry an opportunity to perform that function by placing it on a more even footing with the government and to encourage individual citizens to wage principled defenses. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity you've given me to testify. I'm available to respond to any questions you may have, either before or after Mr. Gilliam gives his testimony.
Thank you very much. And I think we'll come from Mr. Gilliam.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Joe Gilliam, representing the National Federation of Independent Business, over 14,000 small businesses here in the state of Oregon. I'm here today in favor of this cost rate resolution. Echoing Mr. DiLorenzo's comments, I'll be short and sweet. This does put the small business owner, who is under regulatory control of state government agencies, on an equal footing and I believe it's a good policy way to approach the issue of attorney's fees. For the small businesses, the people I represent, basically two-thirds have 10 employees or less. And when they think that they've been wrongly in, had an enforcement action against them and want to appeal that and take the government on, the cost of doing that is just horrendous. They can't afford it. And when they go and think, should I fight this or just pay the bill, even though they may have a principal defense, they can't afford to take the government on if they can't have the same footing as the government on attorney's fees. I think applying this new policy, you're also going to help the government prioritize their litigation and go after the truly horrendous cases instead of just taking everybody on based on whether they can recoup their costs or not. It should be based on the actual infraction and if they truly believe they've taken the right enforcement. So I'd encourage your support for this bill. It doesn't give business an advantage, a private citizen in any case, advantage over the government, but it does give them more than exactly the same thing that's going to be afforded the government, and that really is the test. If the policy decision is made to that it is a good policy to afford attorney's fees to the government, then it applies the same to the citizen. And that really sets the twist in this, and that's the key. It's a good policy decision for the government, and it should be a good policy decision for the citizen. With that, if you have any questions also.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Questions from the committee? I do have a couple of questions for you. It appears to me that the current system allows a wide open door for coercion and intimidation from government attorneys with deep pockets. It's taxpayer dollars that are funding those bills. And it takes a pretty courageous small businessman or private sector individual to fight them. There's one case that I'm aware of, A-Boy Plumbing Store, I think, when they took on, was it Tiger or Tualatin, and Tiger, third of the Supreme Court, and it was a shameful abuse of their authority. And why, is there any reason that the government should have an advantage in this area of being able to recoup attorney fees?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are several reasons for providing awards of attorney fees in statutes. In the 60s and 70s, many legislatures felt that it would be good to encourage what were called private attorneys general. In other words, individual citizens, encourage them to, in essence, do the work of government, in which case attorney fees were provided to citizens under certain circumstances. But with respect to this particular area, attorney's fees have been provided for the government basically as a mechanism for recovering costs and resources. My argument is not necessarily with allowing, in certain circumstances, government the ability to recover attorney's fees when they prevail. It's fine with me. I just feel that the citizen should be on an equal footing. The citizen, if he or she feels there is a principal defense to wage, should feel should be encouraged to wage it. And unfortunately, the situation today is so coercive because the government can put as many resources as it chooses into pursuing the case. And a citizen who goes to a lawyer for defense of a particular case faces a situation where his or her counsel is likely to say, we will win this case on a principal basis if it takes the last dime you've got. Well, that's not a satisfactory response. And so where government is allowed attorney's fees as a mechanism for recovering costs when they prevail, it is only fair that the citizens should be treated equally.
Other questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Mayor.
I noticed that you've included in this bill not only state agencies, but public bodies constituting cities, counties, school districts, other political subdivisions, et cetera, et cetera. It would seem to me that if you're going to do something this dramatic, that the first thing you got to do is limit it to state agencies, where I would, from what I've heard over time, that would be where the largest amount of concern might lie, especially considering the potential impact on local government with their limited resources these days.
Have you thought about separating this and just moving forward at this point with state agencies?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, I have thought about that. And the reason this version has included local governments is because, first of all, this bill would not impact a situation in which a local government had authority by contract or otherwise to pursue attorney's fees, only if there was a state statute that so authorized. Most of the 125 statutes that we've examined relate to state agencies. There are some, however, that could give, either today or in the future, the ability of local governments to litigate and to recover attorney's fees, for instance, in the forfeiture area. It is possible that someday a statute might authorize a local government to seek forfeitures of property and to recover attorney's fees upon prevailing. Well, if the legislature passes such a statute, should there not be a clear policy established in the Constitution that says if you're going to vest any public body with the authority to do that and to recover your costs, you should also provide an opportunity for the citizen who feels wronged, who wants to make the principal, raise a principal defense, to also have a chance. That's the reason for keeping it. Not because there are many statutes today that that so authorize other local governments to litigate on this basis, but because there could be in the future. And our thought was, why don't we just establish a basic overriding policy, basic overriding policies which I understand many feel should be in the Constitution, and then allow the legislature to go back during the 2001 session and make specific policy choices as to how that should be implemented.
Don't we have some statutes that allow citizens who go up against agencies to get awards of attorney fees?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mannix, we do have some statutes that do that.
Without reciprocity?
We have one in particular that does, that I can think of offhand. And I would just say that this constitutional amendment does not affect that type of a situation.
And then that's my follow-up would be, if we're going to say this is going to be a two-edged sword, shouldn't we say then any statute that provides for attorney fees to a private party going up against a public agency should now be two-edged also as to attorney fees?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, I don't think we should. And the reason is that any private citizen, no matter what the citizen's resources, is in an inherently uneven circumstance when that citizen litigates against the state of Oregon or against the government. Because, frankly, the government can place as many resources from a practical perspective as the government chooses to devote to pursuing the particular litigation. The reason I did not make a suggestion that we should have a total loser-pay process when citizens litigate against the state of Oregon is because citizens and the state are inherently in unequal positions. All I'm trying to do, and all Mr. Killian is trying to do here, is to somewhat equalize that that imbalance. And we hope, we think this goes a long way to doing that.
I can't help it. I understand the concept here, and in some ways they're attractive, in other ways they may be, they have weighty consequences. Sitting on Ways and Means, I've seen very many small agencies talk about how this enforcement action blew their budget and they had to go back to the emergency board, and it was the one time we tried to bring an enforcement action when they talked to Mex Dollars in the Attorney General's office, which is presently charging, I think, $89 an hour for their legal services. I can imagine what it would be like if, say, the Board of Medical Examiners wanted to take a license from a physician who'd been committing serious malpractice, and they found that they had to worry about every time paying the physician's attorney fees when he defended against that action. They may have to cut back their enforcement action in half. The number of times they're willing to take the risk because of the fear that if they lost, they'd end up paying. By the way, there are provisions, as I recall, in certain instances for people to recover attorney fees in these kinds of cases. But what I'm getting at, and maybe I should just put it the question generally, this is a pretty dramatic piece. And we've had some discussion informally the last few days, but the more I thought about it,
shouldn't we choose a few choice agencies and do a statutory referral if we're concerned about the Attorney General's office and their role? Take three or four and be very precise and refer those to the voters as statutory pieces that the voters could look at and could say, yeah, we want that to be a two-edged sword, see how it works, and if it is the dramatic change that we like, then we can build on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, I guess I have two problems with that notion. The first one is philosophic. The second one is practical. The philosophic problem I have is that every time the state litigates against a private individual, the private individual has to take into account as part of his or her calculus the resources that he or she has to defend. Yet, people suggest the state, in deciding whether the state has a good claim, should not have the burden of taking that calculus into consideration. I think the state should have the very same burdens and should have the very same considerations when it decides to litigate as a private party should. Secondly, you may decide during the 2001 session, if this constitutional amendment is adopted, that the best policy is to not provide attorney's fees for either side, in which case you then avoid some of that, you temper some of that consideration. But the third point is a practical one. And, you know, we started out with a statutory suggestion. We started out with Senate Bill 961, which provided attorney's fees one way. We then came up with a compromise. It appears, and we are more than willing to talk some more, but it appears that there is no version of Senate Bill 961 proposing the types of statutory fixes that you suggested that would ever be acceptable. And if that's the case, why should we spin our wheels, adopt a statutory change, only to see it vetoed?
Well, Mr. Kennedy, well, I mentioned referral because I understand the veto conundrum that you have to deal with in these situations. I am curious as to why we don't simply send out a constitutional amendment that authorizes judges to award attorney fees to the losing party in any case in which the judge felt such an award is warranted.
Sure. Any party?
The winning party, excuse me. Who's the winning party? Wouldn't that be a more broad-brush, equitable piece?
I think it would be equitable, provided there were standards that would guide a judge's discretion. But those suggestions have been suggested in the past, too. And they have been met with extreme resistance from the government.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Manning, I would comment on that. There are a few individuals in the state who could outspend many of the governments in the state for the broad purpose of including cities and locals and others. You're going to find a few that could outspend them on a legal basis or would choose to try to get in a spending contest with a government body.
May I follow up on that? Why don't we do something, if we want to be radical, that's a little different but tempered, and say that there would be an attorney fee award commission? This is standard. Put it in the Constitution and just say that anybody who felt aggrieved by a governmental process, who felt that they were treated unfairly, could go to this award commission, which would be funded by the state, by the way, for starters, to seek redress and make it a very limited kind of commission and just say, these folks get to decide, regardless of the statute, if someone's been treated unfairly in the process by the government, that they will get an award of fees, regardless of any other statutory provision. But then you focus it, you made it state-funded, and you said, this is your relief valve for someone being treated, I'd say unfairly, maybe there's a better term for it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, I'd say a lot of the decisions are made on litigation are made so far ahead of that, and I'm just possibly could go to the commission to get your attorney's fees. Part of the attraction for us to this policy is that all these policy decisions on attorney's fees were made from a one-sided point of view. We decided whether it was a good idea to spend the other person's money, where this version, in this way, would allow you to re-evaluate all those policies and decide whether you want to, if it's worth the policy, if it's a good policy, to put your own money on the block.
I apologize. I'm being pulled back. I don't want to be rude.
I'll miss you. It would allow double the policy, all the policies to be reevaluated on not only spending citizens' money, but also spending the tax money. And that's what brings the balance for us. And we're okay, and if the idea is okay, if you make a decision that in a particular case, attorney's fees shouldn't be allowed, then if one side doesn't get it and we don't get it, we can live with that. At least we're on an even basis to make the determination on whether to appeal or to pay the fine and move on.
Further questions? Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sherman. Thank you, members.
We're going to call Paul Snyder and Beth Duncan. Hello, Paul.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
I've got a couple of questions for you before we get started here. Both, as it applies to both the AOC and the LOC, those are dues-supported organizations. How are you funded?
But Mr. Chair, for the record, Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, we are dues-funded primarily.
And LOC?
The same.
And those dues come from member counties and member cities?
Yes, sir.
And are those paid out of taxpayer funds generated there at the city and county level then?
In most cases, my assumption is that they are.
Okay. So you guys are here at taxpayer expense?
That's correct.
Okay. Wanted to make that clear.
Primarily.
Okay. I'm working on a little bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I think I already did that. Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. I just had a couple of comments, Mr. Chair. This is a proposed constitutional amendment, and that's a big deal. It's coming at the very end of the legislative session. Mr. DiLorenzo has testified that he has discovered in his research 125 statutes that provide attorney's fees to public bodies, but not to the other side in the event that the other side wins. You know, it's a matter of how you look at the question. You know, this amendment would undo every single one of those 125 statutes without ever looking at what a single one of them says. To me, that says that at least 125 occasions, the legislature had an opportunity to provide exactly what Mr. DiLorenzo requests and chose not to. The legislature made a policy choice to provide attorney's fees to a public body and attorney's fees to the private party on the other side, and chose to provide attorney's fees only to the public body. And I think it's unwise, in the abstract, to pass out an amendment to the Constitution that totally undoes those statutes without even knowing what the policy reasons were for adopting those laws, or what the effect of the changes would be. I think this is an inappropriate way to address this issue. And that's my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Beth Vargas-Frank, and I'm with the League of Oregon Cities. And I heartily echo what my colleague Paul Snyder just said. And I wanted to respond a little bit more to some of the comments made that this is a basic policy change, and I want to echo what Paul was saying. This is not basic. This is 125 statutes, and we know what goes, all the work that goes into creating just one of those. And personally, I'm not familiar with all 125 of those statutes as we sit here at this moment, and I frankly would not know all the impacts of this referendum if it were to go out. Secondly, I know that local government, along with all other areas, branches of government here, has been depicted as a deep pocket today. Yes. And just sitting there, my recollection is that the city of Turner, and I can only say one city because that's the only city I've heard in my short time with the League of Oregon Cities here this last year, their legal budget, as I understood it for a year, is $1,200. If any of you are at all familiar with legal costs, that will not get them very far on any major case.
It was also depicted that a city, I represent City Soil, speak just to cities, even though government was used rather broadly, that cities could choose to spend their last dime on a suit. And I really take issue with that. Cities are run by the city councils, mayors, citizens, and I think that if a city council were to choose to spend their very last dime, their last firefighter, their last police officer, their last garbage person, I think that that would not be wise. I think they would hear from their citizens. I don't think that that is a viable option at all. I think that they do have, in many instances, very lean legal budgets because they are listening to their citizens, and city councils do not lightly make legal decisions whether or not to sue or how to defend or prosecute lightly at all, in my experience. So another issue that was brought up is that citizens would not have access, that it would be difficult for them to outspend. And in my experience, many attorneys will work on a contingency fee basis, so it's not that you're necessarily having to front the money there. So that's another thing I just wanted to point out. I urge all of you to oppose this legislation, that a constitutional amendment does have greater permanence than statute, and that this is a broad, not a basic policy change. And I suppose if you were to entertain the thought, and I would say in the alternative, if you're entertaining the thought of supporting this, please do so narrowly and recognize that cities are quite different than perhaps the state. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I comment just one more point? This bill not only applies to 125 existing statutes, this has future effects as well. This prevents the legislature from ever enacting another one of those 125 statutes in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder and Ms. Duncan. Why should the government have an unfair advantage in when it comes to litigation? Why should there be such an opportunity for coercion and intimidation on the side of government to try to force small businesses or landowners to do what they would have them do? As there is now, they have no recourse to be able to recapture attorney fees if they find themselves in the crosshairs of a local jurisdiction.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think government should have an unfair advantage. And I'm not sure that that's what's being addressed here. There's Mr. DiLorenzo has testified that he has reviewed, his law firm has reviewed and looked at all 125 statutes, but we haven't heard any direct testimony as to what any of those 125 statutes say, except one. And that's the one where he responded to Representative Mannix's question about civil forfeiture. Civil forfeiture, as I understand it, is intended to take the property of someone who's used property in the commission of a crime away from the person who's committed the crime. And that's the one policy reason that I'm aware of for attorney's fees with respect to governments in the case of property that's been used in criminal activity. As to the reasons behind the other 124 statutes, I don't know, but I assume that there was some, or they wouldn't have been enacted in the first place.
Let me come back to this for a minute. You know, you put yourself in the pocket, in the position of an individual who is being sued, and you believe you've got a good case, and you're going to go up against City Hall. And if City Hall wins, you have to pay their attorney fees. But if you win, defending yourself, you don't get your attorney fees reimbursed. That seems to me to be an unfair advantage.
Mr. Chair, I don't know what these statutes provide. I thought when we came here we'd be testifying on something very similar to Senate Bill 961, and this is different. I don't know what those 125 statutes say, and I don't know what the policy was behind them, but I assume that there was some valid reason perceived by the legislature at the time that they were enacted. And I think it's incumbent upon us to find out what they were, before in a very broad, sweeping, last-minute way, we undo them and prevent them from ever being enacted in the future.
Well, the simple act of passing this bill today is if we go there, it does not undo them. It would give the people of Oregon an opportunity to choose and vote upon whether or not this is a basic, is a fair premise. And I think the people of Oregon would say no, that it's not. Questions from the committee? Lieutenant Devlin?
Just one question. What's your reaction to Representative Mack, one of his suggestions about a broad constitutional amendment that would basically say that the judge can award to any prevailing party if the judge believes it's warranted?
Chair Representative Devlin, this is just a reaction. I don't see anything terrible about that, but I remember in the context of this issue having come up before, came up in the form of discussions about possibly statutorily doing something like that, that people who oppose that concept said that basically the effect of it is just to raise the cost of litigation. You either should have nobody getting attorney's fees or everybody getting attorney's fees. When you move to everybody getting attorney's fees, it increases the nuisance values of the case. Of course, it helps the attorneys, but the litigants don't do too well.
President Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this question is slightly more directed at Mr. DiLorenzo. I do know from seeing the list of the 125 statutes and when they were enacted, if you could, I don't know if that's something that he or committee staff could provide us with.
You can also ask LP for the one, I think.
But it would be nice to see the date of the when they were enacted.
Okay. Any further questions from the committee? Okay, we will note that and have a staff tell you and get that to move forward. And for some of these, I would think that it may be some of the information related to 961, perhaps, Central 961, and we'll see what we can dig up. And we will report this shortly. Close the public hearing on HCR 86, the gas one amendment. We'll go now to let's see here. This is Morgan around. She wanted to testify on Central 99. And go to Representative Lundquist. She just wanted to testify on Central 99. Yeah, that's Jeff calling. We will open a public hearing on Central 99. We'll call Dave Honeycutt, and would you please give us like, an overview of Central 99, please?
It has changed since we have arrived at the hearing room, Mr. Chair. We came in with no amendments. We now have three sets of amendments. The original intent of the bill was to exempt certain outdoor mass gatherings from land use permit requirements. We have the -4 amendments from Senator Bryant, and we have -5 and -6 from Representative Barr.
This is not
the restriction. No, I have them here.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of the -6 amendments to Senate Bill 99. I think the easiest way to explain Senate Bill 99, the gut stuff, I think the easiest way to explain the bill is that it it says that gatherings of less than 3,000 people that will last for less than 120 hours within any three-month period are not land use decisions under the zoning ordinance. The local governments will regulate them under health and safety regulations, but not under the zoning ordinance. What this
does is that
less than 3,000 people for less than 120 hours within any three-month period. This bill codifies existing case law in the Fence versus Jackson County case. Both the Oregon Court of Appeals and the Oregon Land Use Court of Appeals, LUBA, have case law to the effect that these short-term type gatherings, weddings, family reunions, picnics, things like that that are occurring, these short-term gatherings are not land use decisions. They're not governed by the zoning code. They're governed by the health and safety provisions in the county ordinance. And so we are simply codifying the existing case law in that area. The other things that the A6s do, which I also believe is, I think we all believe is the current law, is on lines 4 and 5 of the A6 amendments. It adds language to the definition of land use decision, and it specifies clearly that gatherings of over 3,000 people that will last for more than 120 hours are clearly land use decisions. There could be an argument, like suppose somebody could make an argument that those aren't, but I believe that the case law also indicates that those longer gatherings of a long-term duration are land use decisions and should be governed by the zoning ordinance. There's no opposition to the A6 amendments. Matter of fact, we worked the A6 amendments with both the Association of Oregon Counties and the DLCD. The bill passed out on the Senate side 28 to 1, I believe, or 27 to 1 or something to that effect. It's a good bill. It solves, it clarifies some problems that the local governments and the DLCD and ourselves are having. It makes the law clear, and we urge your support.
Okay. President Smitty?
To clarify, this bill has no opposition that you're aware of.
Chair Simmons, Representative Starr, that's correct.
All the folks who are at the table, this heard in the Senate for pride.
Chair Simmons, Representative Starr, this, I think everybody in the world has looked at this bill because this bill was originally the secondary lands bill, so when it was scheduled on the Senate side, everybody who has any interest in this area at all took a look at it and made sure we weren't moving the secondary lands bill.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's reflected in my file with all the letters I received with the original bill. Could you just give us a little more, Dave, a little bit of a history on that? You said this is codifying a court case. Could you just give us a little bit for the record what that was about?
Chair Simmons, Representative Edwards, the Fence versus Jackson County case involved a ordinance in Jackson County that actually tried to make gatherings of less than 3,000 people that were lasting less than 120 hours land use decisions. And Mr. Fence, who wanted to have some type of gathering, I believe he was a Native American, he wanted to have some type of gathering on his property, objected on the grounds that his gathering was a mass gathering regulated by the mass gathering statute and not by the county zoning ordinance. Both LUBA and the Court of Appeals agreed, and so we're just putting that into existing law.
Thank you.
This one, Delvin.
Oh,
is that you, Vinny?
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm Delvin.
Oh, thank you. Well, just a clarification, you may have already covered it. Nothing in this would actually affect the ability of the local governments to require normal non-land use permits for gatherings in terms of public safety and other concerns.
Chair Simmons, Representative Devlin, that's correct. These gatherings will be regulated by local governments under their health and safety codes. There's obviously First Amendment, they're limited by the bounds of the First Amendment, but their health and safety regulations will continue to apply.
for the question? Thank you very much, Mr. Honeycutt. Call Art Schlack.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I too at this point support the A6 amendments to Senate Bill 99. We were concerned initially with respect to the bill, and our concerns at this point are alleviated by the A6s. I would note for you that current state statutes in 433.735 related to regulation of outdoor mass gathering, this section basically is what we're talking about codifying at this point. The A6 amendments will clarify in the land use statutes what is regulated as a mass gathering at this point and what is not, and what is a land use act, what has to go to, what is a land use decision. So this clarification does both ends now in the A6, and that was one of our concerns. So we're happy with the A6.
Any comment on the dashboard?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't at this point. They only affect cities, and it does not affect counties at this point. And what it does, in essence, is that on a road vacation, you need the signatures of the owners, that are property owners are involved, and they have to be notarized. I believe the A6 has taken the requirements for notarized signatures, would delete that for vacations within cities. It has no effect on the legislation that relates to road vacations in counties at this point.
Questions from the committee? Mr. Flatt? We can find some more votes in a little work session.
We have four. And then that.
You guys agree with this?
Okay.
Okay. Let's do that then. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 99, open a work session on Senate Bill 99. Representative
Carr. This is the A6 amendment to Senate Bill 99.
Carr, is there a motion for us to move the A6 amendment to Senate Bill 99? Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chair, I move the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 99.
Is there a motion for us to move the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 99? Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Chair, I move the bill as amended to the floor with staff recommendation.
Is there a motion to move Senate Bill 99 as amended with the dash fours and the A6s to the floor of the due pass recommendation? Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And Representative Carr will be the carrier and the closer work session on Senate Bill 99. What do we have that wanted to testify on 404? Anybody? A good work section. Okay, let's get Buyer and Representative Buyer and Representative Mannix in here if we can. Yeah, we will extend it ease for a moment. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 404. Mr. Moore.
Mr. Chair and committee members, on SB 404-A, since the last time we discussed this bill, it was brought back into committee. You have in your packet edition dash AMR 5 amendments, dash A 6 amendments, and dash A 8 amendments. Dash MAR 5 amendments replace the original bill, define game mammal and exotic mammal, prohibit sporting amusement and attaining appropriate size.
Do you want a motion on that one, Mr. Chair?
Don't go back.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Where are we? I'm ready for a motion for a work session. Our staff summary isn't finished yet.
The A-6 amendment incorporates the dash A-3 and dash 4, which was adopted by the committee. The dash A amendment incorporates the dash A-3 and dash A-4 amendment, but also place the bill under the wildlife law, Oregon chapters 496, 497, 498, and 501, which you have in your packet, which defined as, quote-unquote, can be referred to as wildlife law. Under that, I've given you a copy of the penalty for violation, which shows as a Class A misdemeanor, which is already under the wildlife law. And also, that amendment requires the Economic Development Department to do a study on economic feasibility and Community Department for Development of Operation Planning Preserve. I've also touched base with FISCO, and they were not able to get a report at this time. They have passed information on to the Economic Development Department for response. Depending on the nature of the study and establishing the record of what they're seeking and what the committee would like to seek out, to determine what the cost would be, so the cost of this project qualify and unknown in terms of the definition and scope of the project. And that brings the committee current.
Okay, so Mr. Moore, where is the change in the Class B to Class A misdemeanor here?
Okay, Mr. Chair, the change from a Class B to Class A is not required, as I talked to legal counsel, because the fact that the Class B was shown in the original amendment of the bill, and by placing this under the wildlife laws, it automatically comes under that chapter, which is a Class A misdemeanor. And the I provided the committee with a copy of that section of law to show that it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, Mr. Moore. Where in this amendment are we placing it under those wildlife laws?
Okay.
Chapter 498.
Chapter 498.
Wildlife laws.
Wildlife laws. Under
line 5. I see that.
If you look under chapter 496.002, which you do not have, there it defines which chapters are under the wildlife laws, which are chapters 496, 497, 498, and 501. And this bill is being put under 498.
I'm sorry.
It's going to put under wildlife laws.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Representative Byer, do you have a motion on the A-8 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move the A-8 amendment into the A and Growth version of the bill.
Because there's a motion before us to move the A-8 amendment into the bill, is there any discussion on the A-8 amendment?
Will you please call a roll?
Representative Byer. And Representative Byer, do you have a motion to move the bill as amended to solely be passed recommendation? Your ways and means.
Mr. Chair, if I have been recognized, yes, I move as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, could you review that fiscal again? What was the number you had?
There is none.
Indeterminate. So why don't we go down to Ways and Means, Mr. Chair? give them an opportunity to review this and make sure we don't, in a delicate balance of budget negotiations here in the building, we don't upset anything along the way. Trying to be cautious.
That sounds good.
Mr. Chairman, for the sake of the record, we would have offered the minority report, and we know what the vote total would have been on the minority report on the committee. But since the motion has already been made and President Byers can recognize that obviously we'll just have somebody offer the minority report in Ways and Means. If it ever comes up in a way, then
he knows it.
Further discussion? President Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to again reiterate my opposition to canned hunt. This is not a canned hunt bill. This is a game preserve bill. I joined with my colleague from Beaverton and co-sponsoring the bill that outlawed canned hunt. I don't have a problem supporting this bill because that's not what this is.
Okay. Please call the roll.
Representative Fire.
Aye.
Representative Devlin.
No.
Representative Edwards.
I'm going to vote no because I've never heard of things coming down to Ways and Means without when there's no fiscal. So I'll be a no.
Representative Carton.
No.
Representative Mann.
Aye.
Representative Carr.
Aye.
Representative
Aye. And Senate Bill 404 is named goes to the Committee on Ways and Means. Opposed to the work session on Senate Bill 404. So we will open a work session on, we have one more item on our agenda here today, I think. It needs to be dealt with in some form. On Senate Bill 194. And,
we would very much appreciate a staff explanation and the possibility that someone from the Treasurer's Office could be allowed to set on the amendments.
Okay, we do have Dash 1 amendments available for Senate Bill 404. And can you give a summary of the...
Yeah,
you can if you want. I don't care.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 194 establishes maximum administrative charges that may be imposed by the state treasurer for investing specified public funds, subject local governments to the same administrative charges as state agencies if the state treasurer transfers assets of local government investment pools to short-term investment funds, declares an emergency, and would be effective July 1, 1999. The F1 amendments that you have delete the provision to allow the treasurer to charge local governments for banking-related activity based on a prospective fee structure, delete the proposed increase of maximum administrative fee and restores the current .025 monthly charge, delete the option for state treasurer to discontinue local government participation in the investment pool, remove the emergency clause, and require the state treasurer to maintain the investment pool as a service to local government and seek maximum return on the investment. And I do have some written testimony from the treasurer.
Oh. And we have dash twos also, don't we, Ben?
Oh, yes, I forgot that one. The dash two amendment came to us shortly before the meeting from Mr. Brainy, and those are from Portland General Electric and Northwest Natural Gas. These amendments establish the Office of Energy separate from the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs or Business Services, requires governor to appoint administrator of the new Office of Energy, authorize the Office of Energy to expend monies authorized to be expended by the Office of Energy that is now in the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and any of those funds that are unexpended on the effective date of the Act. It also transfers the funds, rights, and obligations intended for the Office of Energy in DCBS to the newly created office. DCBS, the Treasurer's Office,
and the governor have no objection to the inclusion of the Dash 2 amendment in Senate Bill 194.
Mr. Governor, you had a request to call someone from the President's office to testify.
Yes. One of both the amendments from forward from the President's office.
Chair, for the record, my name is Raleigh Wisbrock, Chief of Staff of the American Treasury. With me is Cynthia Burns, a representative of the Attorney General's staff, and can answer any of the legal questions that I'm going to address relevant to the Dash 1. Basically, I think the bill has been well outlined. The bill allows the Treasury to charge local governments actual costs for their participation in the local government investment pool. Participation in the pool is voluntary, and you really want to underscore that. The local governments, in fact, do not have to participate in the pool if they do not want to, but it offers them an extraordinary investment opportunity. I believe local governments overwhelmingly have shown their support for this bill in the letters and the concerns they've had in trying to move Senate Bill 194 forward. I'd like to raise the question of what happens if Senate Bill 194 does not pass or if it's amended with the Dash 1 amendments. But what happened is constitutionally dedicated funds end up subsidizing local government and participation in the local government investment pool.
Mr. Wisbrock, define for me, if you would, constitutionally dedicated funds.
Any funds like the Common School Fund, PERS, gas tax, any of those that are participating in the fund.
Does it also include the budget allocated to the State Treasurer's office from the legislature?
No. Any cash that would be available in that budget may be invested through the short-term fund, but it is not, the State Treasurer's budget is not a constitutionally dedicated fund. These are funds that the Constitution has said will be used for a specific purpose. The Constitution, as interpreted by the Attorney General and the Supreme Court, states that you cannot use those funds for any other purpose than for what they were constitutionally dedicated. And the Dash 1s would put us in violation with those, with that constraint.
Can you explain how?
Yeah, I very well can. Constitutionally dedicated funds can be used.
Which funds are the ones that are constitutionally dedicated that this bill deals with, and how Athens Amendment would intermingle or cause a constitutional?
The Common School Fund, for example, is dedicated for the purpose of supplying revenues to K through 12. If you would use its resources, the interest earned on its investments, to help underwrite the cost of local governments to participate in this fund, you are violating that constitutional provision.
Can you show me in the bill where we do that?
Go ahead.
Yes. The bill, by requiring the Treasurer to continue to maintain the fund when the fees would not be available from local governments to operate the fund, would be that violation.
I'm sorry, can you show me like a line on a page in the bill, which, what, three?
Yeah, that's up to the hand.
Would you look at the amendments, Dash 1?
We have a hand engrossed version of it. It would be helpful too.
Yeah, let me refer to, and since you please jump in and help here if you can, where you're restoring the 25 basis points. Thank you. On line 8, in deleting the 50 basis points, you're restricting the ability to charge the fees necessary to operate the fund. Let me jump down to Section 7 and 8 in total. Then Section 8 would say the Treasurer shall maintain the investment pool as a service to local governments. This pool is a voluntary pool, which is saying that we will have to continue to operate this pool as a service to local governments. Now, who's going to pay for that? Where do those monies come from? Well, the monies to operate this pool come from those 25 basis points to 50 basis points that are taken off the investment. And that comes from, and that's the line back to the constitutionally dedicated fund.
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, maybe I can explain basically how 293.718 works. That's the statute that allows the funding from the investment funds to the treasurer's office to pay their expenses. And that statute has always read that you can pay 25 basis points from the various
investments.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm Cynthia Burns from the Attorney General's office. That has always said that you can take 25 basis points from those investment funds to pay the expenses of the state treasurer. We've provided advice previously that although it says 25 basis points, that was intended as a maximum, and you can take up to 25 basis points based on how much it costs to operate the individual fund.
That is the cap. The cap that we're trying, you know, to get in 194 established a cap of 50 basis points. That would cover the direct cost of local governments participating in that pool, and it's free for that. Without the ability to charge the local governments for the cost that they incur specifically, we would have to shut down that fund.
We've seen that this fund has been unconstitutional up to now because you've charged only 25% basis points and apparently cost more than that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, when we get to the point that we exceed 25 basis points, whenever that will be, and I'm not sure that it is now, but we have been reviewing this fund, and we think that that will happen in the imminent future, that when we cross that threshold, we will be compelled to shut down the fund. That's when we will begin violating, which is why Senate Bill 194 is before you. It allows us to avoid that crisis in shutting down the $2.7 billion fund that provides about $60 million for local governments in increased investment returns, including schools.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Mack.
What I'm trying to understand clearly here is, and this picks up on Representative Starr's question, why the need to increase the basis points? Has there been some history where you've been running over as to the basis points, or is it because of the size of the fund or the volume of transactions or what? I'm just trying to get a better understanding of that.
Mr. Chair? Representative Mannix, we are at the point where we will begin exceeding the cost of 25 basis points for the local government investment pool. We are at the point of exceeding those 25 basis points. It is a cap now.
If I can clarify my question. Thank you. Are basis points an absolute feature, or are they a relative feature that rise and fall with the fund? Because I really don't know much about this fund.
Mr. Chair, the relative in the sense that investment returns, they're not relative. Right? Basis points are a specific number, it's a percentage of a percentage. As you know, it's a quarter of 1%. What rises and falls is the basis points are attributed to the interest earnings. We will take the basis points off the interest earnings. So the interest earnings fluctuate, and they can go above or, you know, certain rates, and they can go below current rates. But the 25 basis points is charged on the interest earnings.
And the problem, if I may,
Director Nash,
the problem that you're running into is, let's face it, these days with the sophistication of investment markets and the like, there are times when there may be increased expenses and the basis points that's allowed in the current statute as a maximum isn't going to cut the mustard.
It has up to now. The reason why, Mr. Chair, Representative Manning, that's exactly right. It hasn't cut the mustard, I mean, going down to that basic term. And the reason why the bill is before you is to allow us to increase that capacity to charge local governments what their actual costs are. That would avoid the issue that I'm pointing out with the constitutionally dedicated funds. It would also avoid a problem that we have. PERS is a different kind of fund. PERS is a trust and takes its tax-exempt status from the IRS, the single purpose.
No, and I understand the PERS setup. That part's not a problem. I just want to
figure in play here.
Why we're hitting it, and it seems to me it's still a matter of the cost of more sophisticated investment activity and that sort of thing. The reality is, if you want to do well with these funds, you need to have some investment in terms of services. And sometimes you're worried about hitting over this level, the 25 basis points level from the current statute. That's
correct.
A fair way of describing the problem.
I think that makes some sense.
Mr. Weisbrock, if you haven't quite stated clearly whether or not you have been in violation of this constitutionally dedicated fund issue that you brought forward here or not in the past, and it remains somewhat nebulous. And if 25 basis points has been quite adequate up to now as a cap, that's understand as a cap. It appears to me that well, we do have an economy that is expanding and things do change gradually over time. It seems to me that if it's going through to a 50 basis points cap is extremely generous.
Mr. Chair, with me is Darren Bond, who's the head of our investment division, and I think he can give you, you're asking for a very detailed question, and I think he can give you a specific answer to that. Let me give you the general answer. We're telling you very clearly that the 25 basis points will not cover the cost of the local government investment pool portion of it, and that if it does not cover those costs, that fund will have to be shut down. But let me have Darren come forward and answer this other question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Darren Bond, Ashley's Director of the Finance Division, although I do appreciate Raleigh's attempt to promote me for Canada. The basic reason for needing to increase the cap is that we've been in a very positive interest rate environment for the funds for an extremely long period of time. As we just saw during this past week, Fed has increased rates, and when that happened, we had a very quick and massive exodus of funds out of the Oregon Short-Term Fund. As the big players for the local governments, particularly like Portland and Multnomah County, jump out to grab the short-term investments because of the size of our fund, we tend to lag a little bit the market in those kinds of scenarios. Over the course of the years, we provide an above-average return. But they do have options that they can jump out and grab, and they have. We saw about $500 million of local government money leave in the last week. In that kind of a scenario, if you look like back to 1994 when the Feds increased the rates in succession, three different meetings, the rates were increased each time, and the local government money, discretionary money in general, in that time in the Oregon Short-Term Fund, is going to run out to those short-term investments. And the balance of the Oregon Short-Term Fund can dramatically fall in a scenario like that. Our anticipation is in that kind of a scenario, we'd be probably looking at the Oregon Short-Term Fund, and that's state and local government money combined balances of around $3.5 billion. At $3.5 billion, for us to run the Oregon Short-Term Fund with our current cost structure would cost to take about 0.41 basis points, as opposed to the 0.25 basis points that's currently in test.
And again, what we were just trying to extrapolate here was, why do we have the higher basis point needs? One is apparently local governments are getting more sophisticated and some of the big players will pull out, which means your actual shared costs will go up because you're dealing with smaller accounts. And there's, let's face it, with more money in and larger accounts, then there's more efficiency. So you're driven towards less efficiency, which would explain why you have this pressure point to move up to the 50 basis points. That's what we were trying to understand before. I can understand if I've got, you know, some big accounts pulling out, I'm going to lose my efficiencies, and I can still be good, but relatively my efficiencies are down. And it sounds like that's the drift you have to deal with in these booming times.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mannix, that's exactly the case. And in fact, in that kind of a scenario, while on the surface it would appear that in general our costs should go down, in fact our costs, our transaction costs tend to go up because we actually end up trading more. We have more transaction activity because of local governments running in and out of the pool. We trade in smaller blocks. We tend to get shorter because we're trying to keep a real short maturity horizon on the short-term fund so that we don't continue to get burned as rates continue to rise. So we have the same number of accounts, the same number of customers, we don't have the benefit of a cost reduction as we have this decreasing revenue stream.
to move on. There's still the issue of there's an IRF issue, not just an Oregon Constitution issue. We don't want to violate the Oregon Constitution. We also don't want to step over the IRF line of the single purpose use of the funds, and where those funds would be used to support this fund.
No, let's clarify. You would use PERS funds to support it. You may use revenues generated from management of PERS funds.
Those are PERS funds.
Revenues generated from management of PERS funds of the state for management of PERS funds are still PERS funds?
Any funds, yes. Any funds generated from the investment for the PERS funds, Straub versus the state of Oregon, states that those funds are specifically the property of the fund itself, those funds. Now, you can charge fees, but they have to be responsible and equity with the benefits provided. In other words, you can't use the returns, the PERS, the interest off the PERS money to run any of the other funds or to underwrite your local government investment. So you can't do that. That would jeopardize, in fact, the single purpose tax exemption for the PERS fund and losing that tax exemption, of course, bankrupts the state.
Ms. Weisbrock, on line 11 of the bill, and you have the Hannah Gross version before you, and it is on line 11 of page 1 of the Hannah Gross version. It says that proceeds from such charges shall be deposited in the miscellaneous receipts account established in general funds of state treasury. Correct. Now you're telling me that you keep proceeds from PERS management in one item in this miscellaneous receipts account and proceeds from management of the LGIP in one account in this one line item in this miscellaneous receipts account?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simmons, if that's what was indicated, that what we do in fact is that we try to structure our charges, that we charge our administrative fee to PERS, to say to any of the funds, commensurate with the expenses that we incur for managing those funds.
And those expenses are put in this miscellaneous receipts account. Those are charges.
Yes. And we pay the bill because we are incurring expenses for all of the funds. And what we do through our costing of treasury business, through the allocation of those costs, is identify where these expenses, what programs they're associated with. Which is a lot of what's driving this, is we have, you know, the current process, the 0.25 basis points was only put in place in 1995. It was a new process we were putting in place to try to come to an industry standard methodology of charging for our businesses. Prior to that, it was a very archaic process of charging based on income earned, which created a very volatile revenue stream. And the legislature stopped it in 95 to move to an industry standard. We picked a number that looked like it would work very well, and at the time it did because we had the Oregon short-term fund buried in with the all of the investment funds. Subsequent to that, we have improved our budget process as much as the legislature has asked us to do over the years, and we have a much more systematic and rational cost allocation process at Treasury, and I can much more definitively identify my costs to the programs to create those costs. And what that shows us is operating the Oregon short-term fund now is right at that cap and very close to it. And as we enter into an environment potentially where the balances of that fund are going to substantially decline, then we can be in a scenario where it doesn't pay for itself. And that's what we're trying to avoid here. This doesn't provide any additional revenues to Treasury. This is just a matter of us trying to equitably allocate the business that we do and the services we provide, allocate those costs to our customers that use those services. And all of the customers that we have that are using these services are aware of the bill. There's no opposition from them relative to this bill. The Local Government Investment Pool is a very positive program. There's $2.7 billion in there today that indicate this is a very positive program for local governments. And if it wasn't, then the money would move out. But in fact, it isn't. And they're not here to testify that this is a bad bill because this is a very rational bill. The other aspects of the bill relative to charging transaction fees to local government, they're very much in favor for because it puts a user fee aspect into the bill
that hasn't been there before. Currently, the only way.
I think the point that I want to emphasize here is that these costs are paid from an aggregated account.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
That's right. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, I guess. Number one, I heard you say a moment ago that currently your cost is 41 basis points because of a mass excess of funds this week. What that tells me is you're already unconstitutional.
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, no, if I said that, I believe what I said was that in what we believe is a worst-case scenario, something similar to what happened in 1994, that we believe in worst case the balance of the fund would drop to about $3.5 billion. At that, suffering a drop like that, then it would require about 0.41 basis points to fund the...
Okay, that's what I heard. Okay. My next question would be, you're talking about a very sophisticated accounting system here where you can accurately track costs and allocate where it goes, and that's why you need this bill. I've looked through my entire packet, and I got quite a packet from the Treasurer's Office indicating what local governments are using the fund in by district, which is interesting. You got almost right, I must add. But I see nowhere an accounting thing to show the numbers of why you need this. And before I can look at this bill, somebody's got to show me some numbers and to say why today it's okay and tomorrow it won't be. I've got to see those numbers.
Mr. Chair.
All right. This is Devlin. You want to respond to that just briefly? Go ahead. You can tell me it's an environment.
Representative Byer. Unless Darren can give you exact numbers, I can't prophesize the future. We're saying that based on what we know and the trends that we see from the that we can analyze from the past, that there is a time in the near future that we will cross that line. I don't know when that time will be. I don't have that crystal ball. Without this bill, the fund will shut down.
Mr. Chair, I didn't ask for a prediction of the future. I asked for a show me the past. You said you've got a very sophisticated accounting system now, and you know that you're going to cross that line. And I want to see those numbers. I want to know why.
Jen, can you share that one?
We're not going to be able to move this thing. Some of us have an obligation in half an hour we've got to get to. So let's take some questions on this dash, and we can come back to it again. We're not going to have a dash two, and some folks here would like to briefly go to dash two with us before we get out of here. So, Representative Devlin?
Two quick questions. One, other than the funds that have been indicated, are there any other funds that are within that fund that would be dedicated?
Gas tax?
Yeah.
There's a whole list of investment funds that are referred back to that are in 293-712, and it includes OPERF and the Deferred Comp Fund, which are not constitutionally dedicated but are under the Internal Revenue Code restrictions. And then there are funds like the Veterans Sinking Fund, a lot of the bonds, the Federal Obligation Bond Sinking Funds are in there, and those are dedicated funds. And the Common School Fund, the Education Endowment Fund. There are about 20 funds.
This bill was submitted, I assume, what's the original, but I assume it's pre-session filed.
Yes.
And obviously the treasurer has presented his budget pre-session, and you've mostly done some estimates. Is it reflected in your budget what the potential costs are in terms of payments for a local government for services? In terms of that, the management of the funds, I mean, with this difference, basically creating, they're paying a certain number of basis points for you providing the services. That has to be reflected somewhere within your budget, and if you've done a budget that basically projected what your true cost might be, it should be within that budget, wouldn't it, or would it not?
Mr. Chair, if I understand the question, I think what's reflected in our budget, and this is not a direct cost, this is a pass-through cost, but is the 25 basis points of the revenue at the equivalent now of what that revenue is. The increase in basis points is still supplied the same level of revenue. It's, and the idea is to keep this as revenue neutral as possible.
Okay, I see what you're getting.
you have less accounts that you're managing, that your revenues in the state primary are the same, but the basis point per account would be going.
Would have to go up, or the cost would say, now you'd have fewer accounts to pay those costs, so they would have to pay an increasing value more, I think.
Any further questions?
Okay. Could you just one more time go over the point that you made here, which I think is, to me, besides the LGIP, which is very troubling, but the second point, which is the point about the IRS purpose provision. I mean, what is it that you make a pretty bold statement here that you might lose your tax exempt status? Can you just give us a little bit about why that would happen and what that means?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, let me give you just a brief, and then I'd like to ask Cynthia to really talk from the Attorney General's point of view. As we understand this particular provision, if funds for the first, if revenues from the first run fund are used for any purpose other than for the benefit of the beneficiaries, that violates the single purpose dedication of that entire trust fund. That's what gives us the tax exemption. We get our tax exemption, the IRS tax exemption, because that trust fund has a single purpose, and that's to provide services to the beneficiary. If you use revenues, and that would be interest, the interest off of PERS investments to underwrite local governments or any other fund or anything else, it would violate that principle. And what we're saying, and this is not an abstract concept, this is what is going to happen, that if we are compelled, as in the Dash 1, to underwrite the cost of running the fund and as a gift to local governments from PERS, that would violate that principle. That's the basic idea. And I'd like to have Cynthia add a comment to it.
I'll just clarify a little bit. Under both the Deferred Compensation Fund and OPERF get their tax-exempt status from the Internal Revenue Code. For OPERF, that's under Section 401A, and for the Deferred Comp Fund, it's under Section 457. And what those statutes say is that the trust fund, if it's used for the exclusive benefit of the beneficiaries, will maintain its tax-exempt status. And that language has been interpreted to say that you can use monies in the trust fund only to pay the benefits to the beneficiaries, as well as administrative expenses recently related to running the fund. And you can't divert those monies away for other purposes, so that diverting them to support the administrative expenses of another investment fund would be an unlawful diversion of those monies.
And I want to pick up on one statement you make here on the record, Raleigh, which is by losing that, you say it would be a financial catastrophe.
I don't know if I can even comprehend, you know, what it would cost the state if the benefits from the PERS fund would be taxable to the retirees. We're talking billions of dollars at risk. And of course, before we get to that point, the litigation would be extraordinary. I'm not sure that, and I'm going to get on some really sensitive ground here, Mr. Chair, but I'm not sure that we have
I think I can help you not get on that sensitive ground. Realistically, if that were to happen, you'd be in front of the emergency board asking for general fund money to subsidize the operation of this fund so that you wouldn't. And certainly the emergency board would take care of it. I would think that would be the answer. Because, of course, we don't want PERS to lose its tax-exempt status, and the simple solution would be an emergency board appropriation. Your point would be, why are we using state general fund to subsidize the administration of these funds, which are supposed to be taken care of themselves? And that's the point of the whole debate. If I may follow up? Now, Senate Bill 194, the Hampton Gross write-up, and the proposed actual amendments, also delete this subsection 2 of 293.353 on page 1, lines 15 through 18. And the related provisions, the changes to 294.882 in section 7. What is your reaction to that?
Mr. Chair, if I might.
PX or user fee asset that allows us to charge transaction fees to local government. Actually, something the local government has been very much in favor of. And again, injecting equity. Right now, if I have a $10 million local government account that does 2 transactions a month, and a $10 million local government account that does 100 or 1,000 transactions a month, they're both going to pay exactly the same amount of money, and our cost for those dues would be significantly different. And this would allow us to have a user fee aspect in combination with the administrative fee to make
so more equitable. If I have them, I may have low volatility, low turnover, low activity of funds. I'd much rather be paying user fees for each activity and a very low overall administrative fee as opposed to having to pay a higher administrative fee to subsidize volatility when it's someone else's money that's constantly being fooled around with.
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Very much.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity. And I guess we'll be discussing it again.
Yeah.
Let me underscore just my last point. This is a very serious bill because of the constitutional implications of the bill, and we don't want to shut down that fund. It provides an extraordinary service. The Dash ones would create a big problem for us. It would have us make decisions that we're trying to avoid discussing here about whether we comply with the Constitution or the statute, and we don't want to be put in that position.
Does your budget, your appropriation, contemplate the passage of this or not contemplate the passage of this as originally proposed?
I think the budget contemplates the revenues coming in at a steady stream.
Yeah.
So I guess the short answer is yes.
Mr. Greeny, Mr. Vincent, you can explain the Dash 2 explanation of the Dash 2 amendments.
For the record, Steve Vincent with Avista Utilities. I brought forward these amendments as a utility. There are a number of programs that the Oregon Department of Energy provides our utility as well as our customers. Everywhere from a new water heater that a homeowner purchases that might be eligible for tax credit to the siting of energy facilities where, for instance, Northwest Natural recently put a new piping ground that requires Department of Energy involvement. The reason the utilities are bringing this forward is that we're concerned that as the Department of Energy remains a department within DCDF, that there is a loss of quick reaction to needs and decision-making as we serve our customers and try and maintain our system. I could go on and on, but I know you don't want to stay here for too much longer. The governor's office supports this, DCBS supports this, utilities support it. We're the ones bringing it forward and believe that this is makes government more efficient.
Thank you, Mr. Rainey.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Rainey, Assistant Director of the Office of Energy. Just very briefly, this bill just pulls us out of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which we were independent until the 1995 session. There's no revenue or fiscal impact, no change in our mandate, and they're not really a good fit within Department of Consumer and Business Services with the type of licensing and business regulation that their other divisions do. And so we have no objection to this, and again, the Department of Consumer and Business Services Director supports the bill.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Yeah. Mr. Edwards, thank you. Sitting on the sub of Waste Means Education, we heard 5012. Why wasn't this brought in? I don't recall this discussion.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, it was not, I think, question of timing. I don't know why it didn't come up till now. The limitation in terms of budget transfer would be a wash. There's no change, no increase or decrease in terms of what limitation would go to the Office of Energy, whether within DCBS or separate under this bill.
Thank you. Any other questions?
timeframe. That's what the last couple of paragraphs on page 3 of the bill, section 10 there, that's what they accomplish. Just simply to make sure that if we're pulled out, we do have a budget based on what was in House Bill 5012.
Representative, the co-chair of Ways and Means also asked about this issue before her, if we'd run this issue through a substitute committee and not Ways and Means. So that's another reason why we're here, not in Ways and Means.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. That goes to the work session on Bill 104. That's before us. We're